Well, thank you. Thank you so much. We took up our outreach collection a little earlier, and one of the many things that has made me very proud over the years to be the minister of this congregation is how we have, the many ways in which we have reached out to our wider community. One of the things I've along that line that I've also appreciated quite a bit has been how our providing meeting space for various 12-step recovery groups that meet here on a weekly basis. One on Friday night, one on, Monday evening, and then another early morning meeting as well. In this way, our building itself is yet another one of the ways that we do our outreach to our community. I have to say I feel blessed, blessed in the sense I've never had to deal with any kind of a really serious addiction myself. Probably beyond crossword puzzles, which I can't seem to stay away from. But seriously speaking, I admire the courage and I empathize to the extent that I am able with persons who do struggle with a crippling, potentially life-threatening addiction of one kind or another and the steps they take, the means they take to overcome that. Well, when I think about the philosophy or the spiritual stance, that's probably a better way of putting it, behind the 12-step recovery process, I have to say I go back and forth as to how well I relate to it. Last Sunday, I kind of got a head start on this sermon by speaking briefly to the origin of the Serenity Prayer as authored by Reinhold Niebuhr. I talked about how I found wisdom in it, both above and beyond its theology. Simple words, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the wisdom, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, today I'm going to follow up on these thoughts by offering some of my take on the 12-step program and process itself. Well, I got an insight into the effectiveness of this program quite a few years ago now. It was at a UU minister's retreat, something a colleague shared there at that gathering. I have to respect confidentiality, even though this colleague has since passed away, so I'm going to call him Mike. Mike told of how he had returned to the parish ministry after his alcoholism had necessitated his taking a step away from it for a time. He just gotten to the point where he wasn't able to function as a minister, and he had to step away from it. He was at this retreat after he had, as I say, found his way back to the ministry. His death a couple years ago was unrelated to his earlier struggles with alcohol, which he had managed to overcome. Well, in the course of this conversation, Mike recounted how after numerous events to get himself sober by relying on the power of his will, he found himself once again stretched out on a cot in a detox ward after yet another bottoming out episode. One of his sons had found him passed out in his apartment and had brought him there. I'm going to paraphrase his words. Here's what he said to his colleagues recounting that experience. This time, instead of trying to pull myself back together again, I just gave up. I decided I had nothing left in me to help me deal with my addiction. But then he went on to say, it was that very act of giving up that turned out to be the beginning of his recovery. He said that when he stopped relying strictly on his own resources and turned to whatever powers that be, which were in some sense beyond him, my one-time colleague recounted he found a strength he didn't know he had in dealing with his addiction. He went on to become involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and, to the best of my knowledge, stayed sober for the rest of his life. Well, what struck me about this story as I got to know this minister a little better over the years. He and I connected at various other times. And in the course of our conversations, I discovered that theologically speaking, he and I were pretty close. Like me, he considered himself to be a religious humanist who disavows the idea of a supernatural supreme being who can directly intervene in the workings of nature and in human affairs. But the idea of a power in some way greater than the self became very real for him. So a higher power, deeper power, inner power, these were all terms he came to be comfortable with, even though, like me, he traveled rather lightly with the word God. Well, I know that some of our fellow Unitarian Universalists, including some in our congregation here, have come to find an affinity between 12 steps, which is meaningful to them, very helpful, if not life-saving to them, and our liberal approach to religion. So I want to deal with this subject for a little while this morning. I'm going to focus on three areas. I'm going to take a brief look at the origins of the 12-step movement, and then I want to devote some particular attention to what I think the terms letting go and higher power might actually mean, because I find some interesting, for me, dynamics there. And then finally, I'm going to end up by asking that we be a welcoming congregation to people who have found a positive direction for themselves by way of the 12 steps and a belief in a higher power, however varied within that term those beliefs might be. Well, let's take the first one first. Practically every movement of a religious or even secular nature, or sometimes it's some of both, all these type of movements have their founding story. Alcoholics Anonymous certainly included. And Dave Robbins spoke to that a little earlier in our service. This one's set in Akron, Ohio in the summer of 1935. A salesman originally from Vermont who had relocated to New York and from whom you've already heard. He'd been through a series of business successes and failures, and he found himself down and out in Akron when a deal he'd pinned a lot of hope on fell through. The man was named Bill Wilson. He had developed, as already indicated, a pretty serious drinking problem over the course of his career, and he found himself on the verge of turning to the bottle again. He had also been somewhat acquainted and found some help from time to time in his life through the teachings of what was called, the Oxford Movement. Take a little side trip on that for just a minute, do a quick hit on the Oxford Movement. It was an evangelical Christian enterprise that was largely aimed at American college campuses in the early 20th century. It was founded by a gentleman who had set up shop right next to Oxford University in England to propagate his, or to put forth his ideas. Had no connection with Oxford University whatsoever, but he thought calling it the Oxford Movement gave it a nice sound. Well, this movement, I'm not talking about Bill W. now, I'm talking about the founder of the Oxford Movement. This movement stressed the need for the complete surrender of one's life to Jesus Christ, the confession of all wrongdoing, making amends and repentances, and turning oneself over to the guidance of God once the surrender was complete. This organization was the forerunner of a movement called the Campus Crusade for Christ, with which I had some rather interesting dealings back during my campus ministry days. Well, all right, let's cut back to Akron. As I say, Bill Wilson, feeling despondent after another business deal has gone through, he's about to turn to the drinking that he had usually done when these kinds of things happen, but something stops him. He calls up a local minister instead. The minister arranges for a local physician named Bob Smith to be in touch with, to meet up with Mr. Wilson. Bob Smith was also acquainted with this Oxford Movement. Well, David already read you the story of that encounter. You think about those names, Bill and Bob. Doesn't get much more basic than that. Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson got together. As already indicated, they found they hit it off. They promised each other, using their own version of these Oxford principles, that they would support each other in keeping sober, which they did, and the rest, as they say, was the beginning of a movement. Well, what became the 12 steps and what is known in AA circles as the Big Book is basically Bill Wilson's reworking of these Oxford principles. He took them out of their Christian context to make them more widely acceptable and even applicable to a wide range of religious belief, as well as probably a secular mindset as well. And he applied them specifically to combating alcoholism. That is to say, he de-Christianized these Oxford principles. He removed the references to Christ, began using terms like God and higher power interchangeably. And that is the admittedly truncated Cliff Notes version of how Bill W. and Dr. Bob started AA. Well, if we move ahead, over the past 77 years, this started in 1935, over the past 77 years, the movement has spun off other programs to deal with other addictions like overeating, narcotics, gambling, to name but a few. Spanned other movements from that, like Al-Anon for families, persons who are not alcoholics themselves, but are in families that are having to deal with an alcoholic member. And whether or not one considers AA to be a religion, I'm not going to argue that one today, it did have its religious origins. But it's also evolved into a variety of ways. It has become a cultural phenomenon that has become a spiritual path for millions of people. It has become more than a deliverance from an addiction or from psychic pain. It has become a way of life and a spiritual practice all on its own. Well, on that note, I'm going to go to my second point, which is to offer some of my takes on that. And to do so, I'm going to cite the first three of the 12 steps, because they're the ones I'm going to focus on, with some minor tweaking. This is the original Bill W. language. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, her, or it. Well, I can see how at first reading, maybe even second, third reading, this could set off a certain number of alarm bells for religious liberals, to say nothing of secular humanists. The whole notion of being powerless and turning our lives over to a power greater than ourselves and looking to he, she, or it to remove our character defects, well, I can see where that goes against the grain, the ways many of us think and believe and act. But I would also say, don't blow that language off too quickly. Because I find that when I look through the language of the 12 steps and its references to a higher power, rather than simply at it, it takes on some meaning, which I, as a religious humanist, can appreciate. And the best way for me to explain this is to do one of my back up and take a little side trip and come back and hit it again. So that's what I'm going to do for the next couple of minutes, by taking a look at one of the harsher critiques of the 12-step higher power movement. And then I'm going to offer you my critique of that critique. So just hang in there with me and we'll all get there. The critique to which I refer is a book that came out some years ago. The title was Alcoholics Anonymous, Cult or Cure. Title probably gives you some gist of the book right there. Written by two very esteemed psychologists, a Dr. Charles Buff, B-U-F-E, and Dr. Albert Ellis. Dr. Ellis, the founder of a movement in psychology called Rational Emotive Therapy. And the essence of these two gentlemen's argument in this book they co-authored is that buying into a 12-step program and affirming a belief in a higher power makes one powerless and devoid of any self-esteem. They concede there's some human value in the 12 steps, but not a whole lot. Among their assertions are things like this. It is difficult to see how step one can do anything for those who accept it other than contribute to low self-esteem. Of step two, they say it promotes the idea of individual helplessness. Of step seven, I didn't cite that one, but step seven, which calls for asking forgiveness of those you have wronged, they say humility is the virtue of those with poor self-images. And it goes on. You get their drift. Well, learned gentlemen, as these two are, I have to take issue with them on several counts. First, to get the easy one out of the way first, to maintain that seeking forgiveness is a sign of a poor self-image is just plain silly. I dare say we've all had to seek forgiveness at one time or another in our lives. And it's usually because we have realized that our behavior, attitude, intended or not, has been harmful to another person, and we want to make things right. I see absolutely no diminished self-image in doing any of that. But that's not my main issue with these guys. I got to go after them on two other counts. The first one, quite simply, is that their claims do not square with my own experience. And by that, I mean the experience of what I have seen or known, not that I've experienced directly any of these addictions, as I said earlier. I'm talking about my experience of what I've seen and known. And then second, there's a paradox. There's a very subtle interplay between being in control and letting go, which I think these two learned gentlemen, for all their knowledge, are just plain missing. Let's pick up that first one. The people I have known, some of them very close and near lifelong friends of mine, who have used the 12 steps, and for whom the concept of a higher power is very real, are anything but helpless zombies in the manners that Drs. Ellis and Buff suggest. To the contrary, they are usually people who have finally come to feel some sense of personal empowerment and self-worth after years of feeling worthless due to their addiction. Their self-esteem, like that of my colleague in that detox ward, was already shot. And it was following the 12 steps that got it back. As I say, that's a personal observation. As for the admittedly heavy-laden God talk in these steps, the 12-step people I've known take a familiar line from a pretty familiar song that says, "Take what you need and leave the rest." By this I mean they adapt the language to their own religious or spiritual or even secular perspectives. They use the 12-step language to build a spiritual base that is their own, rather than just swallowing a bunch of verbiage, unquestionably, as these two critics seem to suggest. For example, the oft-invoked phrase in the 12-step higher power language is "let go and let God." Now, these words are usually invoked not for the sake of swallowing down some prepackaged notion of God, but rather as a way of helping the person lighten up a little bit on his or herself. I recall a conversation with a new member here some years ago who had come to Unitarian Universalism by way of the 12 steps. For her, as she told it to me, the operative word in that "let go, let God" phrase was "let go," and then leave whatever "let God" might mean to take care of itself. Now, there's a paradox at work here, and I happen to be one of those people who believes that most truths are found in the midst of paradoxes instead of straight out "it's got to be true or false" type of statements, which is another way of saying I prefer the paradox to the polemic when it comes to my own search for truth. Which finally gets to my second argument with Drs. Ellis and Buf, who are polemicists with little apparent appreciation or understanding for the workings of a paradox. What they do not seem to see is the paradox or the interplay or the interweaving between being in control and letting go, between personal power and powerlessness. They don't quite seem to get that. Recall again my late colleague's story. After relating how he gave up, he went on to say that when he let go of so desperately trying to control himself and his drinking, that was when he discovered, who knows from what source, some kind of a renewed power he was able to tap into and get his life back in order. Neither he nor I could offer a rational explanation for that. He just knew it was the case, and I believed him. So it seems to me, admittedly as an outsider looking in on this thing, that this turning to a higher power takes the immediate weight of whatever a person is struggling with off of his or her back in such a way that the person then actually gains some freedom and power to deal with it. And that's the paradox. Once I stop trying so blasted hard to be the master of my fate and the captain of my soul, I find I actually have the power to do just that. So call it a higher power, call it God, call it, and this is my preference, a deeper power, call it whatever one wishes. The idea is to find a reference point somewhere other than the overburdened self. Now, from my own religious and spiritual perspective, that reference other than the self to which I just referred ultimately proves to be some of the deepest wellsprings of the self. But if you're desperately trying to maintain control on one level of your being or psyche, you could actually be blocking yourself from reaching some of those wellsprings that are there on another level. To put it another, you have to let go on one level, that is, in order to take control on another. And this is the truth that I see beyond what I know can be troublesome language for some in those 12 steps. Maybe another way of putting it is to say, you got to get over yourself on one level in order to really and truly find yourself on another. Well, I want to move to a close now by citing two of our UU principles that I think are relevant to this subject. There's that seventh one that says we affirm the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. That could be seen as a theological statement, but it's also a self-evident truth. We are a part of a larger, interconnected web of life that ultimately sustains and nurtures us. We do not live entirely on the strength of our own will and self-direction, as crucial as those things are to living a meaningful life. The message contained in this seventh UU principle is that we need our connections as much as we need our self-reliance. We need our connections to one another, our connections to the earth and its rhythms, our connections to what we know and believe ultimately grounds us and in which we place our final trust. One of the reasons for a liberal religious community and congregation like this one is to offer a place where these kinds of connections are discovered and then celebrated and lived out. So perhaps a UU variation on that let go and let God phrase will be let go and embrace your connections. Second principle I would put before us is one that says we covenant to affirm and promote acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Among the many, many paths that bring people to our doors and then into our community is one that has involved a spiritual awakening of one kind or another, which has come sometimes in the midst of a crisis or a trial. It's part of the stories I hear about people who say they come here. Sometimes it'll be because some kind of a crisis or life-changing event has kind of turned on a spiritual light bulb for them, and they're looking to go somewhere with it that doesn't quite fit with a more orthodox kind of religious faith. Persons like these are coming here and other UU congregations looking for a place to deal with and make some sense of their awakening. I hope we can offer a safe and affirming and accepting place for them. We come here then by many journeys of the Spirit. People come to us by way of many paths of discovery and meaning. And for all of these journeys, I hope we continue to commit ourselves to offering for each and all of them a welcoming home. Let's sing together hymn number 301, Touch the Earth, Reach the Sky.